I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled The History of Ancient Egypt, Part 4. The lecturer is Professor Bob Breyer. Professor Breyer is an Egyptologist and professor of philosophy at the C.W. Post campus of Long Island University. A native New Yorker, Professor Breyer was born in the Bronx, where he still lives today. He received his Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1970. He began teaching at C.W. Post campus in 1972. From 1981 to 1996, he served as chairman of the philosophy department. He has also served as the director of the National Endowment for the Humanities Egyptology Today program. Professor Breyer has twice been selected as a Fulbright Scholar and is a recipient of the David Newton Award for Teaching Excellence. In 1994, Professor Breyer became the first person in 2,000 years to mummify a human cadaver in the ancient Egyptian style. This research was the subject of a National Geographic television special, Mr. Mummy. Dr. Breyer is also the host of the Learning Channel series titled The Great Egyptians. In addition to his television and teaching experience, Professor Breyer is the author of several books and scholarly articles. His most recent books include The Murder of Tutankhamun, Egyptian Mummies, Encyclopedia of Mummies, and Daily Life in Ancient Egypt. Each of Professor Breyer's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, a bibliography, and the ancient Egyptian alphabet in hieroglyphs. You might find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Lecture 37, Dynasty 22, Egypt United.
Hi, welcome back. Remember last time we ended with Egypt divided? We had the high priest of Amun in the south in Thebes ruling from there, and we had a separate dynasty ruling at the same time in the north. Well, this time we're going to see Egypt united again, but it's going to be under foreigners. First time we're going to see this, that really we have foreign kings ruling Egypt, and these are the Libyans. Now, let me emphasize something. In 30 minutes today, we're going to talk about the Libyan dynasty. They're sometimes called the Bubastite dynasty because they rule out of a town in the delta called Bubastis. 30 minutes, we're going to cover the Libyans. They ruled Egypt for 200 years. They're just a little brief period in our history, but 200 years, as long as we're covering all of United States history. And that's just a little bit of Egyptian history. So we've really covered quite a lot, and sometimes we lose perspective of just how broad it is. But let me tell you about the Libyans. Now, as I said, they ruled in the delta, Bubastis, a town in the delta. And as if you'll remember, the delta is moist, unstable ground. Temples crumble, blocks sink under the mud. So we don't have very much about them from the delta. It's very hard to reconstruct histories of delta people. But let me tell you how we do it. It's a kind of detective work, putting pieces together. There are several sources for these Libyan kings. One is the Serapeum. Now, if you'll remember, the Serapeum was in Saqqara, Memphis' burial ground. And this is where the Apis bull was buried. Whenever an Apis bull, the sacred bull, died, it was buried in its own tomb. And every time one of these bulls was buried, the king would have a little stela made. And he'd say, during my reign, I buried the Apis bull. So we get lists of kings this way. If you look at all these stelae, the plural of stela, if you look at them, you can see this king buried an Apis bull, this king, and we trace the kings. Well, these Libyan kings wanted to be Egyptian, and they buried the Apis bulls. So these, one source. Another source, they built palaces in the delta. terribly ruined, but there are some blocks of them, and we can use those to reconstruct a little bit of their history. Also, they built at Karnak Temple, the Vatican of ancient Egypt, Karnak in the south, where every great pharaoh built. They wanted to be included, so they built at Karnak, and those are better preserved because it hardly ever rains in the south of Egypt. So we've got those monuments, very important. And one other source, the excavations of Pierre Monte, who found the intact tombs of some of these kings. And I will tell you about that a little later. But these are our main sources. But let's start with the Libyans. Right? Our first king, Shishak I, a Libyan. Now, how does a poor boy from Libya become king of Egypt? Well, he marries the right woman, like anyone else becomes king of Egypt. He has to marry the woman with the royal blood in her veins. And indeed, he marries the daughter of a king of the previous dynasty, Pausanias' daughter. He marries a royal woman. But how did he get chosen to marry the royal woman? Well, the answer is, he's a military man. He has a title, interesting title, the great chief of the Meshwesh. Great chief of the Meshwesh. The Meshwesh were Libyan mercenaries. They were hired by the Egyptians as a kind of police force. The Libyans were a military body. And they had been hired by the Egyptians previously, so this is a military commander who simply takes over and marries the right woman, becomes king of Egypt. You know, it's a little bit like, remember back to Tutankhamun, when there was turmoil at the end of a dynasty? And who winds up taking over? Horemheb, the general? It's like that. When there's turmoil, the military comes in. And this is what happened, because remember, the previous dynasty ended with Egypt divided, king in the north, king in the south. So this Libyan becomes king of Egypt. Now, don't think that he invaded Egypt. Don't think that he marches across with an army. Didn't happen that way. Think about the geography, first of all. Libya is to the west. If you go north to Egypt to, say, Memphis, and hang a left, you'll come to Libya, but you'll have to cross a couple hundred miles of desert. It's a difficult trek, very difficult. And he didn't come with an invading army. No, not at all. He is probably the descendant of Libyans who had been living in the Delta area for many years. Now, think back. Remember the time of Ramses III, the 19th dynasty. Ramses was the last great pharaoh of that dynasty. And one of the things he was proudest of is that he pushed back the Libyans. The Libyans were getting a little bit too populous. The Egyptians, it seems, always minded when foreigners became too numerous. It was okay to have a few. But when they became a large body to be reckoned with, they didn't like that. As, for example, remember the Exodus? The Israelites became too numerous. That's when they really, problems start. Same with Ramses III. The Libyans were getting numerous. And he's proud that he pushes them back. Now, my hunch is, well, it's almost certain, I think. It's not just me. This Meshwesh chief, Shishak, is probably a descendant of captives that Ramses III brought back to Egypt. Because let me read you an inscription of Ramses III, what he says about the Libyans, right? Now remember, this is generations back, right? Generations. Ramses III is speaking. He's talking about the Libyans. He said, "They had reached the bank of the great river from one end to the other. They had taken possession of the cities in that region, right? But I destroyed them. I massacred all of them together. I forced them to go back across the frontiers of Egypt." He's pushing them out. But here comes our man, Shishak, at least his ancestors. "I brought back the rest of some great booty, spurring them on, gathering them like fowl before my horses. Their women and children by the thousand, their cattle by the millions. I enlisted their princes in my fortresses." So he's using the Libyans in his forts, right? "I gave them chief archers and tribal chiefs. I made them into slaves marked with my name." He branded them. "Their women and children likewise. I presented their flocks at the temple of Amun." So Ramses may have indeed pushed these Libyan back, but he comes back with loads of captives. And he gives them to the forts, because they're military people. So I think, you know, as generations pass, these people become integrated into Egyptian society. They become part of it. They even become a police force, the Meshwesh. So our man Shishank is probably the descendant of these Libyans that Ramses brought back as captives, branded. And now he's king of Egypt. It's a success story. Now, what does he do? All right. Well, he knows Egyptian history. He's integrated. He's really Egyptian. He may be a Libyan, you know, ethnically, but he's Egyptian. And by the way, the Libyans were shown on Egyptian walls, temple walls, as quite distinct from Egyptians. They're more fair-skinned, and they often wear a distinguishing feather in their hair. It's the kind of sign of a Libyan. You know, if you look at a temple wall and you see a feather, Libyan. And sometimes they're shown with blue eyes. Interesting. But anyway, what does this Libyan who really is integrated into Egyptian society do? Now, he knows the history. He thinks back. Remember the time of Sneferu? Sneferu was the great pyramid builder, and he's the one who wanted to keep all the power in his family, keep it consolidated. So Sneferu, if you'll remember, appointed his son as vizier of Egypt. Other sons are architects of the pyramids, overseer of the works. Shishank does the same thing. He takes his sons and places them strategically throughout Egypt. Let me tell you about one son, Iuput. Three titles this kid has. Iuput is governor of Upper Egypt. Now what that means is he's really the vizier of southern Egypt. Now that's important for several reasons. But one is, remember, in Egypt, communications is not easy. If you wanted to get a message from, say, the Delta to Thebes and back, you're talking 3 weeks, right? It could take 3 weeks to come, for a ship to come and go. So you needed somebody down there to watch over things. His son is the governor, right? But that's not his only title. He's also high priest of Amun. Now remember, the temples of Amun at Thebes have vast resources. They are wealthy. They have land, all the produce from the land. So he is also covering his religious and economic base with his son, Iuput. But that's not all. Iuput is also commander-in-chief of the army. So this one son is covering three bases. We've got religion with the high priest of Amun and economics also. Right? We've got politics, he's vizier. And we've got the military. He's the commander-in-chief of the army. He's got it all covered with one son. But that's not his only son. He's got another son, great name, Jed-Ta-Ef-Ankh, right? Jed-Ta-Ef-Ankh. The name means something, of course. Jed, if you'll remember from the amulet lecture, when we talked about magical amulets and magic, there was a little Jed pillar, an amulet in the shape of the backbone of Osiris. That's the Jed pillar. Jed meant stability, because your backbone is what makes you stable, keeps you upright. So Jed means stable, right? Ptah, Jed-Ptah. Ptah is stable. Ef-Ankh, causing life, right, or his life. Something like the stability of life is Ta, something like that. So his name is nice, dedicated to Ta, and he is indeed a religious person. He's third prophet of Amun. So in other words, he has a religious title also. Now, prophet does not mean that he predicts things. That becomes the meaning in the Bible when you get these guys saying things that come true. Prophet simply means he's the third order of priest. Very, very high, by the way. You got the high priest, you got the first, you know. Third prophet, he's in there. So another son, covering things. And then there's a third son, Nimlot, a military kid. Nimlot is put in charge, commander at Heracleopolis. Heracleopolis is a city in middle Egypt. It's in the middle. Strategic. Somebody's going to give you trouble coming from the south, you've got the commander of the army there. So these three sons have Egypt pretty well covered. Shishank is riding high. He is stable. Feeling good. Now, what does he do? Launches military campaigns. He was chief of the Meshwesh. He's a military man. That's what he knows how to do best. And he sees the right time for a foreign campaign. In 930 BC, Solomon dies, right? King Solomon dies. And he sees that Palestine, the area of Palestine, is ripe for pickings. Palestine is now really two kingdoms, Israel and Judah. and one of the kings is dead, Shishak marches north. Now, he is the Shishak of the Bible, right? We know of him from the Bible. He is Shishak. And the Bible tells us about what happened. Now, roughly, we can reconstruct what happens. Goes to Jerusalem, surrounds the city. He's going to take it. He's got his military, right? Palestine is in disarray. And he's bought off. They give him the treasures of Jerusalem. And listen to what the Bible says. This is Kings 1, right? First Kings. It says, in the fifth year of Rehoboam, Shishak, the king of Egypt, marched on Jerusalem. He took all the treasures from the temple of Yahweh and the treasures from the royal palace. He took everything, including all the golden shields that Solomon had made. In place of them, King Rehoboam had bronze shields made, entrusting them to the care of the officers of the guard who guarded the king's palace gate. So, really, it doesn't say that he destroys the city or anything. He's given all this gold, right? He's given the gold. Interesting footnote, by the way. What does this have to do with Indiana Jones? Right? Well, one of the things that Shishak isn't given, at least doesn't say it in the Bible, is the Ark of the Covenant, right? The Ark, the box that held the Ten Commandments, right? That's not mentioned, right? It's called an Ark, by the way, because Ark means box. That's why you get, you know, like Noah's Ark. It's really a big box that floated on the water, basically. And the Ark of the Covenant isn't mentioned. That's why Indiana Jones goes looking for the Ark of the Covenant at Tanis in the Delta in Egypt, right? Thinking maybe Shishak brought it back, right? But anyway, he's at least given the gold shields. Now, what does he do? Does he take his booty and run home? No, he's on a roll. Marches north, right? Goes to Megiddo. Now, if you'll remember, maybe 10 lectures back, Megiddo was where Thutmose III marched all the way north. And he had that sort of defining moment where he could take three paths. He could either go through two wide opening places or through the narrow valley, horse behind horse, man behind man, and he chose the dangerous narrow one to surprise the enemy. Shishak would have known that. He would have known that Thutmose III did that. It's written right on the walls at Karnak Temple, and those walls were up there for Shishak to read. It may have been hundreds of years ago, but Shishak knew. So he marches north to Megiddo. And he does just what Thutmose III does. He erects a stela saying, I was here, this is my land. Right? So Shishak is really quite a military presence, and he has united Egypt. He's got his sons everywhere. Egypt is under one king. It's on a roll. Now, what else does he do besides beat up people? He builds, and he builds on a grand scale. Grand scale. He erects the largest pylon gateway at Karnak Temple. It's right near the river. And if you think about how Karnak sort of just growed like Topsy, one pharaoh builds a temple, and then the next pharaoh wants to add to it and add to it. So it really grows from the inside out. So this is the latest addition to Karnak Temple. It's right on the river, practically. And it's a big pylon. But what's most interesting about it is when you go in, it's where the tourists go into the entrance to Karnak Temple. When you go in, you can still see how it was built. It's unfinished, never finished. And as you go into the temple, look on the inside wall, and you will see the remains of a mud brick ramp still in place that the workmen used to get to the top where they were carving the top. So remember, with the pyramid, there's a little bit of a doubt, debate about how the pyramids were built, whether it was a long ramp or whether it was a kind of corkscrewing switchback road like around a mountain. At least for pylons, we know they had ramps. It's still there. And it's there mainly because it hardly ever rains in Thebes. So it's still there. But he does other things. He also builds a gateway, separate gateway. It's called the Bubastite portal because they ruled from Bubastis, so they're called the Bubastite dynasty sometimes. And on it, he's got lists of all these cities that he took in the Palestinian campaign, 156 of them. You've got little fortresses. He draws a little fortress on the wall. You can see little crenellations, the little bumps around the walls where the archers stood behind. And inside is the name of the city that he took, 156 of them. And one of them has an interesting inscription, really interesting. It says, if you read the hieroglyphs and you sort of say it out loud, it's Yudea Melech. Melech means king, as in even in Arabic, it's Maluk, Hebrew, same thing. King of Judea, right? It's the king of Judah, the kingdom of Judah, showing him captive too. So he's bragging about his exploits, and he's doing just fine. Now, he was buried at Tanis, but his tomb was robbed, so very little has been found. His son takes over as the next king, Osirkan I. One of his inscriptions claims, and I emphasize claims, that he gave 487,000 pounds of silver to the temples. Now, that's a lot of silver. A lot of silver. Either he's exaggerating, which is certainly possible, or they've hit the mother lode and silver, the price of silver has dropped. But it is interesting that as he's talking about giving all the silver to the temples, his family is being buried in solid silver coffins. Right? Now, he is, again, going to follow the family pattern of putting your sons in good positions, placing them in good positions. And he does that. Takes his son, right, and he makes him high priest of Amun in the south. Not only that, he makes him co-regent. But the son never really takes over. But when he was co-regent, think about what he had. In a sense, you've got a king of Upper Egypt and a king of Lower Egypt simultaneously. One's your son, you're not going to have any problems. So, it looks like Egypt is going to be stable. The son dies, though. This is a son named Sheshant II. He dies before he can become king on his own, right? And he is succeeded by a king about whom we know hardly anything, except his name was Takalot. And now I want to tell you about this fourth way I told you we had about knowing about these dynasties by Pierre Monte's excavation. It's one of the most amazing excavations in the history of archaeology, and nobody knows about it. You might be wondering why. Pierre Monte discovered it during World War II, and there was a war raging around him. Right? North Africa had a war going on, and he is excavating a royal tomb. Very difficult. Monte was an interesting archaeologist. He started his career in the 1920s in the Levant, in Lebanon, Syria, and he discovered many objects with the names of Egyptian kings. And he became interested in these foreign exchanges. You know, how does an Egyptian object wind up in Byblos, in Lebanon, you know? And he became interested in this foreign exchange. So he decided to excavate in Egypt. Now, where is he going to pick? The Delta. Remember the Hyksos had been there, right? You have the Libyans are there. So he goes to the Delta, and he excavates at Tanis. Now, he excavated at Tanis because he wrongly believed that that was the biblical city of Ramses, because it had all those big statues of Ramses. It was a reasonable guess. But if you remember from the last dynasty, they'd been brought over. They'd been hauled over by the new dynasty. So it was. He was wrong about that. But his selection of a dig spot was perfect. 1939. He is excavating at Tanis at the Temple of Amun. And he decides to pick up the pavement stones of the temple itself. In other words, temples aren't just built on mud. You have paving stones. Picks up the paving stones, and he finds a tomb, a royal tomb. Now, he enters the room, and he finds that it's been robbed. It's been plundered. It has. But there, in that tomb, are the remains of the burial of the kings of this dynasty. So there are many objects still there, and this is an important source about how we learn about this dynasty. But the story doesn't end there. Behind that plundered room was another room, intact, a hidden room. And when he entered that, he found inscriptions on the walls that said it was the tomb of the king Pausanias. Remember, Pausanias, also pronounced Susani, same pharaoh. And there was a coffin, a silver coffin, solid silver. But it wasn't for Pausanias. It wasn't. It was for this next king that I said nobody knows anything about, Sheshonk II. Right? Now, without Monte's excavation, we'd know nothing about this king. But think about it. We have an intact royal burial. Coffin. Solid silver, right? It's got a gold mask. It's even got little coffinettes. Now, remember the internal organs were taken out and placed in canopic jars? Four canopic jars? Well, Tutankhamun had very special ones going back a few centuries. His canopic containers were little coffins. Four of them for the liver, stomach, intestines, kidneys. Sheshonk II had exactly the same thing. Little coffinettes. Somehow, the memory was there of this sort of... There's nothing in between the two kings that had, who had other coffinettes like this, but somehow the memory... But this is an important burial. Think about it. A royal burial, intact. But it didn't end there. Behind that tomb was another intact tomb. That's where they found the intact burial of Pausanias, the king. And it didn't end there. Monte really found four virtually intact burials. I mean, when he got to Pausanias' burial, you know, he had to chip away a granite plug about 5 feet by 5 feet. It took him 6 days before he got into the tomb. They really wanted to prevent robbers from getting in, and they succeeded. But there's a funny ending to the story. He found this intact burial, and there was still another chamber behind it. Now, remember, he's working pretty much in secret. He doesn't have guards. You know, there's a war going on. Doesn't want anybody to know he's found gold and silver. Right? He's not broadcasting it to the news media, saying, come on in and take pictures. Not like Tutankhamun. But word gets out, of course. You know, you can't keep such a thing secret. He's got workmen. And who shows up on his excavation? King Farouk. King Farouk arrives one day. Gets a tour. Explains that there's an intact tomb there, but I'm not ready for it because I've got to consolidate what I've got so far. Farouk says, open it. Right now, it's his country, right? Monte opens it. And it's another intact tomb, right? Of the son of Pausanias, Amenhotep, right? So he's got another intact tomb. And it didn't even end there. In 1946, he found still another intact tomb of a general, right? So Monte really supplies us with an awful lot of information about Dynasty 21, the previous one, and this one. It's a fantastic treasure that people just don't know about. Monte only published it in French. You can't get an English translation of his work. But if you want to see it, go to the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. And on the second floor are these silver coffins, gold masks, wonderful treasures rivaling Tutankhamun's, but hardly anybody knows about it. It's an amazing discovery. But anyway, back to our dynasty, right? These are powerful kings with great treasures. Now, we have some more kings following. Takalot I follows him. Little is known about him. And then comes Osakhan II, okay? And what we're going to see here is a little bit of a family feud. His cousin, Harisi, is made high priest at Karnak. Again, keeping it in the family. But what does Harisi do? He declares himself king. So now you've got it again. You've got two kings, northern and southern. But anyway, Harisi dies. And what Osakhan does is he replaces Harisi with his own son. Right? So he's consolidating it pretty quickly. Now, at this time, though, there's going to be a threat to these Libyan kings. Right? Assyria is growing strong. Assyria. Right? All the way to the north. And they're marching south. They're marching south. And believe it or not, I mean, given what we've had about history so far, something rather surprising happens. Egypt allies itself, right, allies itself with Byblos and Israel and marches north and stops Assyria on the Orontes River, far away from the border of Egypt. They don't want these Assyrians coming close, right? So, at least for now, the Assyrians are moved out. Now, we have another king coming in, Takalot II, son of Osakhan II. And he maintains the stability. Right? Things are stable. Right? He builds. And what we have to understand at this point is, where is this stability coming from? It's coming from the wealth of Egypt. You see, even in times when Egypt is politically in distress, when there's feuding, there are certain constants. Now, what are the constants? The Nile is overflowing. Doesn't matter what your politics do, that Nile is going to overflow. And that Nile is going to enable your peasants, your farmers, to grow crops. More crops than you need. You're going to have a surplus of crops, because that's the great thing about Egypt. They could always grow more crops than they needed. That's how you can afford to feed thousands of priests for the temples of Amun. And that's how you can afford a standing army. So the peasants are going to be growing crops. And this surplus you can trade for things like silver, gold. So there's a kind of wealth of Egypt that's almost impossible to kill. It's not like, for example, when a neighborhood runs down, it's kind of gone, there's no value to it, it doesn't have anything positive about it, people aren't interested in it. When Egypt was in turmoil, People were always interested in it. It was still wealthy. Still wealthy. So during Takawat II's reign, there's a kind of stability of wealth. Of wealth. But during his reign, there's a civil war. It lasts for nearly 10 years. Back and forth, people want the wealth within the family, perhaps. So there's battling, real battling. There's one kind of rebellion where Takalot moves quickly, kills the leaders. Doesn't just kill them, though. That's not enough. Not enough. He burns their bodies. Now, that's a statement. No chance of immortality. Right? Remember, they are resurrectionists. If you don't have your body, you're not going to get up and go again in the next world. So he burns their bodies. I mean, it's a kind of brutal display of don't mess with me. Doesn't want this civil war to continue. Anyway, the civil war does continue. Right? There are problems at the end of this dynasty. And we even have a group of people popping up at another delta city, Leontopolis, Lion City. Now, it's important to remember this is in the delta also. These people are ruling from Bubastis in the delta. And now we don't have faraway kings claiming their king. We have them almost next door neighbors in the delta. And this is a dynasty that we, you know, it's a competing 23rd dynasty. We call them 23rd. They're minor. They're nobodies. But they take names that you like Sheshonq, like Osirkon. They're naming themselves after the great kings. So we have this kind of spurious dynasty, Dynasty 23, ruling in the delta. They're not ruling much. They're just putting their names in cartouches, calling themselves kings. And this dynasty, the real dynasty, our dynasty, the dynasty of Bubastis, ends with Osirkon IV. Right? It ends with him saying, I'm king of all Egypt. And it ends with a few of these minor kings of the other dynasty claiming that they're kings. So, in a sense, we began by unifying with the Libyans. But it ends with a little bit of divisiveness. They did great things for 200 years. Don't think this is a brief, you know, passing fancy. They were kings for 200 years. But it ends again with a little bit of a division. But again, Egypt is going to be united once again. But this time, by people who are very closely tied to the Egyptians. The new uniter comes from a surprise place, Nubia. We'll talk about him next time.